Hey, welcome back to Another World Audiobooks. Thanks for tuning in here again today. So good to have you here. I got to give a huge shout out to Sharon, who left a comment on the podcast. She said, "I love Another World Audiobooks. You're an incredible orator. Your voices and accents are flawless. All your book choices have been wonderful as well. Thank you so much for everything." Well, Sharon, thank you so much for everything. It makes my day every time I get feedback like that. So thank you so much, Sharon, for sending that my way. Made my day, made my week, and I'm just so grateful for listeners who are so positive and kind in that way. So if you're enjoying the podcast, would love to give you a shout out on the show. So hit me up, anotherworldaudiobooks@gmail.com, or better yet, if you want to leave a review and then send me a screenshot of that review, that helps the podcast grow and then also helps my ego grow. Maybe not. I'll try to keep it in check. Thank you guys so much for listening. This week, though, you're getting a special treat, as you have the last couple weeks if you've been listening, to The War of the Worlds by Mr. Sam Collins. So make sure to check him out. All the links are in the description below. And without further ado, let's get into it. The next chapters of The War of the Worlds.
Chapter 8. Friday Night. The most extraordinary thing to my mind, of all the strange and wonderful things that happened upon that Friday, was the dovetailing of the commonplace habits of our social order with the first beginnings of the series of events that was to topple that social order headlong. If on Friday night you had taken a pair of compasses and drawn a circle with a radius of 5 miles round the Woking sandpits, I doubt if you would have had one human being outside it, unless it were some relation of Stent or of the 3 or 4 cyclists or London people lying dead in the common, whose emotions or habits were at all affected by the newcomers. Many people had heard of the cylinder, of course, and talked about it at their leisure, but it certainly did not make the sensation that an ultimatum to Germany would have done. In London that night, poor Henderson's telegram describing the gradual unscrewing of the shot was judged to be a canard, and his evening paper, after wiring for authentication from him and receiving no reply, the man was killed, decided not to print a special edition. Even within the 5-mile circle, the great majority of people were inert. I have already described the behaviour of the men and women to whom I spoke. All over the district people were dining and supping, working men were gardening after the labours of the day, children were being put to bed. Young people were wandering through the lanes, lovemaking. Students sat over their books. Maybe there was a murmur in the village streets, a novel and dominant topic in the public houses, and here and there a messenger, or even eyewitnesses of the later occurrences, caused a whirl of excitement, a shouting and a running to and fro. But for the most part, the daily routine of working, eating, drinking, sleeping, went on as it had done for countless years, as though no planet Mars existed in the sky. Even at Woking Station and Horsell and Chobham, that was the case. In Woking Junction, until a late hour, trains were stopping and going on, others were shunting on the sidings, passengers were alighting and waiting, and everything was proceeding in the most ordinary way. A boy from the town, trenching on Smith's Monopoly, was selling papers with the afternoon's news. The ringing impact of trucks, the sharp whistles of the engines from the junction, mingled with their shouts of, "Men from Mars!" Excited men came into the station about 9 o'clock with incredible tidings and caused no more disturbance than drunkards might have done. People rattling Londonwards peered into the darkness outside the carriage windows and saw only a rare, flickering, vanishing spark dance up from the direction of Horsell. A red glow and a thin veil of smoke driving across the stars, and thought that nothing more serious than a heath fire was happening. It was only round the edge of the common that any disturbance was perceptible. There were 6 villas burning on the Woking border. There were lights in all the houses on the common side of the 3 villages, and the people there kept awake till dawn. A curious crowd lingered restlessly, people coming and going, but the crowd remaining, both on the Chobham and Horsell bridges. 1 or 2 adventurous souls, it was afterwards found, went into the darkness and crawled quite near the Martians, but they never returned, for now and again a light ray, like the beam of a warship's searchlight, swept the common, and the heat ray was ready to follow. Save for such, that big area of common was silent and desolate, and the charred bodies lay about on it all night under the stars, and all the next day. A noise of hammering from the pit was heard by many people. So you have the state of things on Friday night. In the centre, sticking into the skin of our old planet Earth like a poisoned dart, was this cylinder. But the poison was scarcely working yet. Around it was a patch of silent common, smouldering in places, and with a few dark, dimly seen objects lying in contorted attitudes here and there. Here and there was a burning bush or tree. Beyond was a fringe of excitement, and farther than that fringe, the inflammation had not crept as yet. In the rest of the world, the stream of life still flowed as it had flowed for immemorial years. The fever of war that would presently clog vein and artery, deaden nerve and destroy brain, had still to develop. All night long the Martians were hammering and stirring, sleepless, indefatigable, at work upon the machines they were making ready, and ever and again a puff of greenish-white smoke whirled up to the starlit sky. About 11, a company of soldiers came through Horsell and deployed along the edge of the common to form a cordon. Later, a second company marched through Chobham to deploy on the north side of the common. Several officers from Inkerman Barracks had been on the common earlier in the day, and one, Major Eden, was reported to be missing. The colonel of the regiment came to the Chobham Bridge and was busy questioning the crowd at midnight. The military authorities were certainly alive to the seriousness of the business. About 11, the next morning papers were able to say, a squadron of hussars, two Maxims, and about 400 men of the Cardigan Regiment started from Aldershot. A few seconds after midnight, the crowd in the Chertsey Road, Woking, saw a star fall from heaven into the pine woods to the northwest. It had a greenish colour, and caused a silent brightness like summer lightning. This was the second cylinder. Chapter 9. The Fighting Begins. Saturday lives in my memory as a day of suspense. It was a day of lassitude, too, hot and close, with, I am told, a rapidly fluctuating barometer. I had slept, but little, though my wife had succeeded in sleeping, and I rose early. I went into my garden before breakfast and stood listening, but towards the common there was nothing stirring but a lark. The milkman came as usual. I heard the rattle of his chariot, and I went round to the side gate to ask the latest news. He told me that during the night the Martians had been surrounded by troops, and that guns were expected. Then, a familiar, reassuring note, I heard a train running towards Woking. "They aren't to be killed," said the milkman, "if that can possibly be avoided." I saw my neighbour gardening, chatted with him for a time, and then strolled in to breakfast. It was a most unexceptional morning. My neighbour was of opinion that the troops would be able to capture or to destroy the Martians during the day. "It's a pity they make themselves so unapproachable," he said. "It would be curious to know how they live on another planet. We might learn a thing or two." He came up to the fence and extended a handful of strawberries, for his gardening was as generous as it was enthusiastic. At the same time he told me of the burning of the pine woods about the Byfleet golf links. "They say," said he, "that there's another of those blessed things fallen there, number 2. But one's enough, surely. This'll cost the insurance people a pretty penny before everything's settled. Ha ha!" He laughed with an air of the greatest good humour as he said this. The woods, he said, were still burning, and pointed out a haze of smoke to me. "They will be hot underfoot for days on account of the thick soil of pine needles and turf," he said, and then grew serious over poor Ogilvy. After breakfast, instead of working, I decided to walk down towards the common. Under the railway bridge I found a group of soldiers. Sappers, I think, men in small round caps, dirty red jackets unbuttoned and showing their blue shirts, dark trousers and boots coming to the calf. They told me no one was allowed over the canal, and, looking along the road towards the bridge, I saw one of the Cardigan men standing sentinel there. I talked with these soldiers for a time. I told them of my sight of the Martians on the previous evening. None of them had seen the Martians, and they had but the vaguest ideas of them, so that they plied me with questions. They said that they did not know who had authorized the movements of the troops. Their idea was that a dispute had arisen at the Horse Guards. The ordinary sapper is a great deal better educated than the common soldier, and they discussed the peculiar conditions of the possible fight with some acuteness. I described the heat ray to them, and they began to argue among themselves.
"Crawl up under cover and rush him, I say," said one.
"Get out," said another. "What's cover against this here heat? Sticks to cook you. What we got to do is get as near as the ground'll let us, and then drive a trench."
"Blow your trenches, you always want trenches. You ought to have been born a rabbit, Snippy."
"Ain't they got any necks, then?" said a third abruptly, a little contemplative dark man smoking a pipe. I repeated my description. Octopuses, said he. That's what I calls them. Talk about fishes of men. Fighters of fish it is this time. It ain't no murder killing beasts like that, said the first speaker. Why not shell the darn thing, strike off and finish 'em? Said the little dark man. You can't tell what they might do. Where's your shells? Said the first speaker. There ain't no time. Do it in a rush, that's my tip, and do it at once. So they discussed it. After a while I left them and went on to the railway station to get as many morning papers as I could. But I will not weary the reader with a description of that long morning and of the longer afternoon. I did not succeed in getting a glimpse of the common, for even Horsell and Chobham church towers were in the hands of the military authorities. The soldiers I addressed didn't know anything. The officers were mysterious as well as busy. I found people in the town quite secure again in the presence of the military, and I heard for the first time from Marshall, the tobacconist, that his son was among the dead on the common. The soldiers had made the people on the outskirts of Horsell lock up and leave their houses. I got back to lunch about 2, very tired for, as I have said, the day was extremely hot and dull, and in order to refresh myself, I took a cold bath in the afternoon. About 4:30 I went up to the railway station to get an evening paper, for the morning papers had contained only a very inaccurate description of the killing of Stent, Henderson, Ogilvy and the others. But there was very little I didn't know. The Martians did not show an inch of themselves. They seemed busy in their pit, and there was a sound of hammering and an almost continuous streamer of smoke. Apparently they were busy getting ready for a struggle. Fresh attempts have been made to signal, but without success, was the stereotyped formula of the papers. A sapper told me it was done by a man in a ditch with a flag on a long pole. The Martians took as much notice of such advances as we should of the lowing of a cow. I must confess, the sight of all this armament, all this preparation, greatly excited me. My imagination became belligerent and defeated the invaders in a dozen striking ways. Something of my schoolboy dreams of battle and heroism came back. It hardly seemed a fair fight to me at that time. They seemed very helpless in that pit of theirs. About 3:00 there began the thud of a gun at measured intervals from Chertsey or Addleston. I learned that the smouldering pinewood into which the second cylinder had fallen was being shelled, in the hope of destroying that object before it opened. It was only about 5, however, that a field gun reached Chobham for use against the first body of Martians. About 6 in the evening, as I sat at tea with my wife in the summer house, talking vigorously about the battle that was lowering upon us, I heard a muffled detonation from the common, and immediately after, a gust of firing. Close on the heels of that came a violent rattling crash quite close to us that shook the ground, and staring out upon the lawn, I saw the tops of the trees about the Oriental College burst into smoky red flame, and the tower of the little church beside it slid down into ruin. The pinnacle of the mosque had vanished, and the roof line of the college itself looked as if a 100-ton gun had been at work upon it. One of our chimneys cracked as if a shot had hit it, flew, and a piece of it came clattering down the tiles and made a heap of broken red fragments upon the flowerbed by my study window. I and my wife stood amazed. Then I realized that the crest of Maybury Hill must be within range of the Martians' heat ray now that the college was cleared out of the way. At that I gripped my wife's arm and without ceremony ran her out into the road. Then I fetched out the servant, telling her I would go upstairs myself for the box she was clamoring for. "We can't possibly stay here," I said, and as I spoke the firing reopened for a moment upon the common.
"But where are we to go?"
said my wife in terror. I thought perplexed. Then I remembered her cousins at Leatherhead. "Leatherhead!" I shouted above the sudden noise. She looked away from me downhill. There were people coming out of their houses, astonished.
"How are we to get to Leatherhead?"
she said. Down the hill I saw a bevy of hussars ride under the railway bridge. 3 galloped through the open gates of the Oriental College. 2 others dismounted and began running from house to house. The sun, shining through the smoke that drove up from the tops of the trees, seemed blood-red and threw an unfamiliar lurid light upon everything. "Stop here," said I. "You are safe here." And I started off at once for the spotted dog, for I knew the landlord had a horse and dog-cart. I ran, for I perceived that in a moment everyone upon this side of the hill would be moving. I found him in his bar, quite unaware of what was going on behind his house. A man stood with his back to me, talking to him. "I must have a pound," said the landlord, "and I've no one to drive it." "I'll give you 2," said I, over the stranger's shoulders.
"What for?"
and I'll bring it back by midnight, I said.
Lord, said the landlord,
what's the hurry? I'm selling off my bit of pig. £2 and you bring it back. What's going on now?
I explained hastily that I had to leave my home, and so secured the dog cart. At the time, it did not seem to me nearly so urgent that the landlord should leave his. I took care to have the cart there and then, drove it off down the road, and, leaving it in charge of my wife and servant, rushed into my house and packed a few valuables, such plate as we had, and so forth. The beech trees below the house were burning while I did this, and the palings up the road glowed red. While I was occupied in this way, one of the dismounted hussars came running up. He was going from house to house, warning people to leave. He was going on as I came out of my front door, lugging my treasures, done up in a tablecloth. I shouted after him, "What news?" He turned, stared, bawled something about crawling out in a thing like a dish cover, and ran on to the gate of the house at the crest. A sudden whirl of black smoke driving across the road hid him for a moment. I ran to my neighbour's door and rapped to satisfy myself of what I already knew, that his wife had gone to London with him and had locked up their house. I went in again, according to my promise, to get my servant's box, lugged it out, clapped it beside her on the tail of the dog cart, and then caught the reins and jumped up into the driver's seat beside my wife. In another moment we were clear of the smoke and noise and spanking down the opposite slope of Maybury Hill towards Old Woking. In front was a quiet, sunny landscape, a wheat field ahead on either side of the road, and the Maybury Inn with its swinging sign. I saw the doctor's cart ahead of me. At the bottom of the hill I turned my head to look at the hillside I was leaving. Thick streamers of black smoke shot with threads of red fire were driving up into the still air and throwing dark shadows upon the green treetops eastward. The smoke already extended far away to the east and west, to the Byfleet pine woods eastward, and to Woking on the west. The road was dotted with people running towards us, and very faint now, but very distinct through the hot, quiet air, one heard the whirr of machine gun that was presently stilled and an intermittent cracking of rifles. Apparently the Martians were setting fire to everything within range of their heat ray. I am not an expert driver, and I had immediately to turn my attention to the horse. When I looked back again, the second hill had hidden the black smoke. I slashed the horse with the whip and gave him a loose rein until Woking and Send lay between us and that quivering tumult. I overtook and passed the doctor between Woking and Send. Chapter 10. In the Storm.
Leatherhead is about 12 miles from Maybury Hill. The scent of hay was in the air through the lush meadows beyond Pyreford, and the hedges on either side were sweet and gay with multitudes of dog roses. The heavy firing that had broken out while we were driving down Maybury Hill ceased as abruptly as it began, leaving the evening very peaceful and still. We got to Leatherhead without misadventure about 9 o'clock, and the horse had an hour's rest while I took supper with my cousins and commended my wife to their care. My wife was curiously silent throughout the drive, and seemed oppressed with forebodings of evil. I talked to her reassuringly, pointing out that the Martians were tied to the pit by sheer heaviness, and at the utmost could but crawl a little out of it. But she answered only in monosyllables. Had it not been for my promise to the innkeeper, she would, I think, have urged me to stay in Leatherhead that night. Would that I had. Her face, I remember, was very white as we parted. For my own part, I had been feverishly excited all day. Something very like the war fever that occasionally runs through a civilized community had got into my blood, and in my heart I was not so very sorry that I had to return to Maybury that night. I was even afraid that that last fusillade I had heard might mean the extermination of our invaders from Mars. I can best express my state of mind by saying that I wanted to be in at the death. It was nearly 11 when I started to return. The night was unexpectedly dark. To me, walking out of the lighted passage of my cousin's house, it seemed indeed black, and it was as hot and close as the day. Overhead the clouds were driving fast, albeit not a breath stirred the shrubs about us. My cousin's man lit both lamps. Happily I knew the road intimately. My wife stood in the light of the doorway and watched me until I jumped up into the dog cart. Then abruptly she turned and went in, leaving my cousins side by side, wishing me good hap. I was a little depressed at first with the contagion of my wife's fears, but very soon my thoughts reverted to the Martians. At that time I was absolutely in the dark as to the course of the evening's fighting. I did not know even the circumstances that had precipitated the conflict. As I came through Ockham,
for that was the way I returned and not through Send and Old Woking, I saw along the western horizon a blood-red glow, which as I drew nearer crept slowly up the sky. The driving clouds of the gathering thunderstorm mingled there with masses of black and red smoke. Ripley Street was deserted, and except for a lighted window or so, the village showed not a sign of life. But I narrowly escaped an accident at the corner of the road to Pyreford, where a knot of people stood with their backs to me. They said nothing to me as I passed. I do not know what they knew of the things happening beyond the hill, nor do I know if the silent houses I passed on my way were sleeping securely, or deserted and empty, or harassed and watching against the terror of the night. From Ripley until I came through Pyreford, I was in the valley of the Wey, and the red glare was hidden from me. As I ascended the little hill beyond Pyreford Church, the glare came into view again, and the trees about me shivered with the first intimation of the storm that was upon me. Then I heard midnight pealing out from Pyreford Church behind me, and then came the silhouette of Maybury Hill, with its treetops and roofs black and sharp against the red. Even as I beheld this, a lurid green glare lit the road about me and showed the distant woods toward Alderston. I felt a tug at the reins. I saw that the driving clouds had been pierced, as it were, by a thread of green fire, suddenly lighting their confusion and falling into the field to my left. It was the third falling star. Close on its apparition, and blindingly violet by contrast, danced out the first lightning of the gathering storm, and the thunder burst like a rocket overhead. The horse took the bit between his teeth and bolted. A moderate incline runs towards the foot of Maybury Hill, and down this we clattered. Once the lightning had begun, it went on in as rapid a succession of flashes as I have ever seen. The thunderclaps, treading one on the heels of another and with a strange crackling accompaniment, sounded more like the working of a gigantic electric machine than the usual detonating reverberations. The flickering light was blinding and confusing, and a thin hail smote gustily at my face as I drove down the slope. At first I regarded little but the road before me, and then abruptly my attention was arrested by something that was moving rapidly down the opposite slope of Maybury Hill. At first I took it for the wet roof of a house, but one flash following another showed it to be in swift rolling movement. It was an elusive vision. A moment of bewildering darkness, and then, in a flash like daylight, the red masses of the orphanage near the crest of the hill, the green tops of the pine trees, and then this problematical object came out clear and sharp and bright. And this thing I saw, how can I describe it? A monstrous tripod, higher than many houses, striding over the young pine trees and smashing them aside in its career. A walking engine of glittering metal, striding now across the heather, articulate ropes of steel dangling from it, and the clattering tumult of its passage mingling with the riot of the thunder. A flash, and it came out vividly, heeling over one way with 2 feet in the air to vanish and reappear almost instantly, as it seemed, with the next flash 100 yards nearer. Can you imagine a milking stool, tilted and bowled violently along the ground? That was the impression those instant flashes gave. But instead of a milking stool, imagine a great body of machinery on a tripod stand. Then suddenly the trees in the pinewood ahead of me were parted, as brittle reeds are parted by a man thrusting through them. They were snapped off and driven headlong, and a second huge tripod appeared, rushing, as it seemed, headlong towards me. And I was galloping hard to meet it. At the sight of the second monster, my nerve went altogether. Not stopping to look again, I wrenched the horse's head hard round to the right, and in another moment the dog-cart had heeled over upon the horse. The shafts smashed noisily, and I was flung sideways and fell heavily into a shallow pool of water. I crawled out almost immediately, and crouched, my feet still in the water, under a clump of firs. The horse lay motionless. His neck was broken, poor brute, and by the lightning flashes I saw the black bulk of the overturned dog-cart, and the silhouette of the wheel, still spinning slowly. In another moment, the colossal mechanism went striding by me and passed uphill towards Pyreford. Seen nearer, the thing was incredibly strange, for it was no mere incessant machine driving on its way. Machine it was, with a ringing metallic pace and long, flexible, glittering tentacles, one of which gripped a young pine tree, swinging and rattling about its strange body. It picked its road as it went striding along,
and the brazen hood that surmounted it moved to and fro with the inevitable suggestion of a head looking about. Behind the main body was a huge mass of white metal, like a gigantic fisherman's basket, and puffs of green smoke squirted out from the joints of the limbs as the monster swept by me. And in an instant, it was gone. So much I saw then, all vaguely for the flickering of the lightning, in blinding highlights and dense black shadows. As it passed, it set up an exultant, deafening howl that drowned the thunder.
Allo! Allo!
And in another minute, it was with its companion, half a mile away, stooping over something in the field. I have no doubt this thing in the field was the third of the 10 cylinders they had fired at us from Mars. For some minutes I lay there in the rain and darkness, watching, by the intermittent light, these monstrous beings of metal moving about in the distance over the hedgetops. A thin hail was now beginning, and as it came and went, their figures grew misty and then flashed into clearness again. Now and then came a gap in the lightning, and the night swallowed them up. I was soaked with hail above and puddle water below. It was some time before my blank astonishment would let me struggle up the bank to a drier position, or think at all of my imminent peril. Not far from me was a little one-roomed squatter's hut of wood, surrounded by a patch of potato garden. I struggled to my feet at last, and, crouching and making use of every chance of cover, I made a run for this. I hammered at the door, but I could not make the people hear, if there were any people inside, and after a time I desisted, and, availing myself of a ditch for the greater part of the way, succeeded in crawling, unobserved by these monstrous machines, into the pine woods towards Maybury. Under cover of this I pushed on, wet and shivering now, towards my own house. I walked among the trees, trying to find the footpath. It was very dark indeed in the wood, for the lightning was now becoming infrequent, and the hail, which was pouring down in a torrent, fell in columns through the gaps in the heavy foliage. If I had fully realized the meaning of all the things I had seen, I should have immediately worked my way round through Byfleet to Street Cobham, and so gone back to rejoin my wife at Leatherhead. But that night the strangeness of things about me and my physical wretchedness prevented me, for I was bruised, weary, wet to the skin, deafened and blinded by the storm. I had a vague idea of going on to my own house, and that was as much a motive as I had. I staggered through the trees, fell into a ditch and bruised my knees against a plank, and finally splashed out into the lane that ran down from the College Arms. I say splashed, for the storm water was sweeping the sand down the hill in a muddy torrent. There in the darkness, a man blundered into me and sent me reeling back. He gave a cry of terror, sprang sideways and rushed on before I could gather my wits sufficiently to speak to him. So heavy was the stress of the storm just at this place that I had the hardest task to win my way up the hill. I went close up to the fence on the left and worked my way along its palings. Near the top, I stumbled upon something soft, and by a flash of lightning saw between my feet a heap of black broadcloth and a pair of boots. Before I could distinguish clearly how the man lay, the flicker of light had passed. I stood over him waiting for the next flash. When it came, I saw that he was a sturdy man, cheaply but not shabbily dressed. His head was bent under his body, and he lay crumpled up close to the fence, as though he had been flung violently against it. Overcoming the repugnance natural to one who had never before touched a dead body, I stooped and turned him over to feel for his heart. He was quite dead. Apparently his neck had been broken. The lightning flashed for a third time, and his face leapt upon me. I sprang to my feet. It was the landlord of the spotted dog, whose conveyance I had taken. I stepped over him gingerly and pushed on up the hill. I made my way by the police station and the College Arms towards my own house. Nothing was burning on the hillside, though from the common there still came a red glare and a rolling tumult of ruddy smoke beating up against the drenching hail. So far as I could see by the flashes, the houses about me were mostly uninjured. By the College Arms, a dark heap lay in the road. Down the road towards Maybury Bridge, there were voices and the sound of feet, but I had not the courage to shout or go to them. I let myself in with my latchkey, closed, locked and bolted the door, staggered to the foot of the staircase and sat down. My imagination was full of those striding metallic monsters and of the dead body smashed against the fence. I crouched at the foot of the staircase with my back to the wall, shivering violently.
Once again, thank you for listening. Make sure to share the show with somebody that you know who might enjoy some free audiobooks. If you haven't checked out the backlist, there are tons of books. There's got to be, we're probably pushing 1,000 hours worth of audiobook content. Maybe not that much, but it's a ton. Hundreds, at least, of hours of audiobook content, all for free, all on this podcast feed. So check it out if you haven't checked out the backlist. That's my favorite thing about a podcast. A podcast with a big backlist means that there's just so much content that you can go through. So if you've listened to every episode on Another World Audiobooks, that's some serious commitment, and I'd love to give you some kind of award for for doing that. If you have listened to every single episode in the backlist, hit me up, anotherworldaudiobooks.com, and I will send you access to all of the audiobooks in our library for free. So I love giving away audiobooks. That's just what we do on the podcast. And again, thank you to Mr. Sam Collins for giving away the War of the Worlds audiobook and putting it on here on the podcast to share with you. So make sure to check him out. And stay tuned for next week. More stuff coming. Talk to you then.